Thanks, Nicole. I don't deserve many of those kind words. And I'm very grateful to see all of you and for everyone who's put so much work into tonight, to the River Rock folks and the women from Westside and the worship team. It's a lot that's gone into this, because I'll tell you, I would not have agreed to do this if I knew that there were this many people here tonight. Public speaking is in my top three of things I said I would never do. I said I would never teach, and I've taught after university. I had no money, and my old high school called me and asked if I'd substitute teach. So not only did I teach, I was like at the, you know, the bottom of the pool where, you know, the kids are trying to pull one on you and they think you don't know anything. So that was my teaching experience. And I also said I would never get involved in politics. And that was something as well that fell in my lap. But spent many years in the bare knuckle politics of municipal politics in Surrey and in here in BC and even federally. And that has been an adventure too that has led to many, many good stories and many, many dear friendships that I don't think I would have, I know I wouldn't have had otherwise. And then my third never was public speaking. And you'd think I would learn. Never say never, because before, you know, when you're young, you know, you sort of say, I will never. But then, I don't know, it's around 30 or so, you start saying, never say never. You realize you don't actually know as much as you think you do. Anyway, although there are many, many friendly faces among you, most of you don't know me. But I would gather that most of you know that I am dying. 6 weeks ago, I was given the news that my liver and bones are full of cancer. Just this past week, I found out that it spread to my skull. And today, even, I went for an MRI to see if it's gone to my brain. Estimates vary, but barring a miracle, it is likely that I will not be here in 6 to 18 weeks, or 42 to 126 days. Sounds like a long time when you're waiting for Christmas or something that's on back order, but when it's the time that you have left to cuddle with your kids or spend with your husband, it's terribly, terribly short. Cancer's been a big part of my life for several years now. I was diagnosed with breast cancer nearly 5 years ago. Quinn, our son, was just 2 years old, and Kate, our daughter, was only 7 months. I was just weaning her when I found the lump. I always wondered how you'd know when you found a lump, but when I found it, I knew. It was hard as a rock, and I knew it shouldn't be there. Because of my age, I was 32, things moved quite quickly. I had a partial mastectomy within 2 weeks, and then began 6 rounds of nasty chemo. I reacted violently to chemo and had to be hospitalized for my treatments. Right after finishing chemo, I had more surgery, this time a bilateral mastectomy, removal of both breasts, and reconstruction. A few months later, I discovered that my cancer was genetic, and so I opted to have my ovaries removed in an effort to prevent the cancer from returning or new cancers from developing. I have taken medication every day for the past 4 years to reduce my chances of recurrence. In short, I did everything I could and more than even my doctors recommended to avoid the situation I find myself in today. And along with breast cancer came the color pink. I've never really liked the color pink. I was a tomboy growing up, very active in sports, and was never very girly. My poor mother would beg me to wear a belt to show my waist because my daily uniform was sweats. So anything pink was really not me. And then I got cancer. And as I'm sure you're all aware, the breast cancer prevention marketers have completely absconded the color pink. Oh, the irony. So on top of my longtime aversion to pink, I find myself suddenly immersed in a world of pink. Pink ribbons, pink thermoses, pink scarves, pink keychains. And there's nothing wrong with all this pink. It serves a wonderful purpose to raise awareness and funds to eradicate the very disease that I am dying of. But for some reason, it always rubbed me the wrong way. And I couldn't figure out why. It wasn't just that I wasn't a fan of the color, because as my closest friends will tell you, I'd begun to freak them out on occasion by wearing something not pink, but coral or fuchsia. What bothered me was the fact that all of a sudden, people were suddenly defining me by my cancer. I was a cancer survivor. And I am. Well, I was. But cancer does not define me. Neither does being a wife or a mother. All of these things are a part of who I am, but they do not define me. What defines me is my relationship with Jesus. And that is why I'm here tonight. To tell you why Jesus defines me. To tell you what I have learned about what is really important in life. And to share the four things, the four principles that have helped shape me into who I am today and give me hope. Over the years, these four truths have established a foundation of faith that is unshakable, even in the face of death. I have shed many tears over the past week as I grieve the reality of my death, and I will no doubt shed many more. But in the midst of my sadness, there is a deep and abiding peace and hope. A peace and hope that I would like for you to have too. So here are the things I have learned, the important truths I want my kids to know. Know God, know yourself, know the gospel, and know your purpose. In Romans 12, verse 2, it says, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect," which is to say, we are changed by what we know. Before we go any further, I want to establish something as a starting point. I am going to quote from the Bible, and I am doing that because I believe it to be the very words of God. Some of you may not agree or hold an opinion that the Bible is a bunch of fairy tales or irrelevant history. Some of you are Christians who wonder if there is truth to these things, or who may approach the time you spend reading the Bible, what God has written for you, as something you should do, rather than something you get to do. There are plenty of books out there that give a better reasoning for the authenticity of the Bible than I could ever give, and I would be happy to recommend some to you. But tonight, we will operate from the assumption that the Bible contains God's words for you and for me. Because as charming as I'd like to think I am, what I say means very little. But what God says means everything. So here we go. The first thing I've learned. Know God. Now, I don't even like to admit this, but I am a bit of a celebrity hound. I have to admit. When Neil and I were first married, we lived downtown Vancouver, and many evenings we would go for walks on Robson Street. Of course, of all the places in Vancouver where one is likely to see celebrities, it's Robson Street. Neil likes to tease me because I often think I see someone famous only to find out that it's not. Case in point, there was this one man that I would see often, and he was the spitting image of Tom Selleck. Remember him? Magnum P.I.? I did actually realize that there was a fair number of people in this crowd that might not know who Tom Selleck was. Anyway, this guy looked exactly like him. I mean, it was crazy how much he looked like Tom Selleck. And I would insist to Neil that it was Tom Selleck. He was tall like Tom Selleck. He had the thick mustache like Tom Selleck. And one day, me and Tom, were standing in the lineup at London Drugs. And I got a really good look at him. And I still thought it might be him. And then I heard him speak, and it wasn't him. We often do this with people, don't we? I kind of think I know Stephen Harper. I have friends who work for him. I have friends who are friends with his wife. I read what other people have said and written about him, and I make assumptions about him, about what I think he is like, mostly based on my political leanings. And your opinion of him may be completely different than mine, especially if our political preferences differ. But in either case, it may or may not be who he really is, because the reality is neither of us know him personally. On the other hand, I know my husband, Neil. I know what is important to him, and I know what he likes and doesn't like. I know his character, I know his strengths, which are many, and I know his weaknesses, which are few. I know him because I want to know him. I spend time with him, I observe him, I ask him questions. There is a natural tendency within us to try and make God who we think he is, or who we think he ought to be. If all is well in our world, our view of God is unchallenged. He is good, he is loving, he is fair. But when things start to go awry, that is when our true view of God is revealed. We think God is not good, or that he is unjust, or that he is not in control because hurricanes destroy whole cities. Children are mistreated and abused. Wars break out and innocent people are killed. Or women get cancer and die, leaving their children without a mother and their husbands heartbroken. We try to fit God into who we want him to be, rather than seeking him for who he really is. As someone said to me recently, "Rachel, I don't believe in your God. I don't believe in a God who would let this happen." Problem is, there is only one God, and we can't make him who we want him to be. He is who he is. In his book, Made in His Image, Steve Lawson agrees, saying, "Our most rudimentary problem is that we do not fully comprehend who he is. Our thoughts about him have become very unclear, fuzzy, and oblique. The result of this distorted view of deity is that it leaves everything else out of focus as well. Whenever we lose a right view of God, everything else gets out of perspective. Essentially, our view of God will inform our view of everything else. It will be the lens through which we perceive reality, and it will shape our thoughts, worldview, attitudes, and perceptions. When our view of God is erroneous, our view of other things will be erroneous by default." One of the most pivotal moments in my spiritual life was when a good friend of mine saw me struggling under my view that God was a stern judge, and that I had to earn his approval or avoid his disapproval. He said to me, "Rachel, there is nothing you can do to make God love you more, and there is nothing you can do to make God love you less." Seeing God as he is, faithful, steadfast, constant, unchanging in his love for me regardless of my behavior, enabled me to rest. God hadn't changed, but my understanding of who he was had changed. And as a result, I was changed. God has revealed himself to us so that we can know him. And he has done this in two ways. He has revealed himself through nature. Psalm 19 says, and it should be up on the screen, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, and night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words, whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." All of nature speaks to the amazing character of God. I always laugh when I read news articles or when new animal species are discovered or some major scientific breakthrough shows again how complex and amazing our world is. We think we know it all, when in actuality we know very little. Just as art is a reflection of the artist, nature is a reflection of its creator. So God has revealed himself in nature. He has also revealed himself through Jesus. The book of John begins like this, speaking about Jesus. In the beginning was the Word, Jesus, and the Word was God. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And in Hebrews 1, in these last days, God has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he created the world. He, Jesus, is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. That is Jesus. Jesus is God. When we learn about Jesus, we are learning about who God is. The whole Bible points to Jesus and teaches us about who God is. God, of course, has many characteristics, but the one I will mention here encompasses many others and describes him and only him. He is holy. Charles Hodge, the Princeton theologian, defines it by saying, "The holiness of God is not to be conceived of as one attribute among others. It is rather a general term representing the conception of God's consummate perfection and total glory. It is his infinite moral perfection, crowning his infinite intelligence and power." Which is to say that he is perfect. And because he is moral perfection, he is separate from us. Because none of us, no matter how much we volunteer, or how much we give at the office, or how much we sacrifice for our kids, or how much we convince ourselves that we are good by saying, "Well, I'm not a bad person because I've never killed anybody," none of us can claim moral perfection, much less infinite intelligence and power. Which leads me to my second point. Know yourself. And here is where I hope you'll permit me a few minutes to rant. I intend for it to be a gracious rant, but it's going to be a rant nonetheless. Everyone has pet peeves, and mine are very well known to those near me. I'm very particular about smells. So people who drench themselves in perfume and cologne, not my favorite. As Neil says, "You're a bit of a princess when it comes to smells." But as I remind him, I adore the smell of Gillette products, so he has nothing to worry about. So I'm particular about smells. Other pet peeves, I really have to bite my tongue when I get poor customer service. When someone in the service industry is thoughtless, lazy, or just plain rude, everything in me wants to get in their face and say, "People, this is your job." Or just a few days ago, I was getting off an airplane and was reminded of another pet peeve. Again, I have many. Ever notice those people who, as soon as the seatbelt sign goes off, jump up and rush up as far up the aisle as they can? And then what happens? They have to wait. Like everybody else. I'm like, why? Seriously? Why? My biggest pet peeve, however, happens in the summer, and there's no way to avoid it because, really, you'll be driving down the road, sun's out, windows are down, there's a nice breeze, life is good, and then you'll see it. A man driving his car without his shirt on. Really. Seatbelt vinyl against sweaty, usually hairy skin. I honestly, it gives me the absolute willies. But my current pet peeve, the one that makes me rant, is the lie of self-esteem. It is everywhere. Oprah is its champion, but what distresses me most is how prevalent it is in the church today. The lie of self-esteem is this: if I believe that I am good enough or that I am worthy enough, I will be happy. In the secular world, it sounds like this: believe in yourself. You deserve it. You have the power within you to do or be anything you want, if you put your mind to it. Learn to love yourself. In the Christian world, it sounds like this. If you just believe that you are loved by God, you will be happy. Or accept yourself, because God has already accepted you. Or God loves you, so you should love yourself. They all sound pretty good, actually. Nothing wrong with that, right? But there is. Do you hear it? Me, me, me. It's all about me. The lie of self-esteem is that I need to do something. I need to believe something. Or I need to accept something in order to be happy or complete. Several people have asked me lately, why would God take you away from your family when a murderer or a rapist gets to live a long life? The implicit assumption there is that I am a good person and I deserve better. But I am not a good person and I do not deserve better. Bear with me as I explain. I have done wrong things. We all have. True, I have not murdered anyone, but I have done things that are wrong. In Romans 3:23, it says, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I know that if I did not get praised or avoid punishment for doing good things, I would choose to spend all my money on me. I would make decisions about how to spend all my time and activities around what was best for me. To find pleasure, my focus would always be on me. Isaiah 53:6 confirms this. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his or her own way. And the sad thing is, culture tells us that this is a good thing. You can do whatever you want if it makes you happy. And sometimes, but not always, we throw in the caveat, and doesn't hurt anybody else. Ever read Lord of the Flies? Several boys are alone on an island. At first they adhere to the rules of civilization, but slowly it begins to break down. Their true natures emerge, and it is not pretty. That is the story of us. Left to our own devices, our sinful nature cannot help but express itself. Sure, we try to do the right things, but doing things on the outside does not change the inside. Our hearts are still the same. Doing things on the outside does not change the inside. Our hearts are still the same. Be honest with yourself. Our natural tendency is not to do good things. I have a sinful nature that is always looking out for ways to make me more comfortable, for ways to get me praise and acceptance from people around me, for ways to get me more of things that I want. I'll use my kids as an example. Since last fall, I have thought that I really need to be a nicer mother. Now, most of you who even know me fairly well would say, you are always so nice to your kids. Not true. Just ask them. I have found that I say no an awful lot. And when I took an honest look at myself, I realized that I was saying no because it was inconvenient to me. I don't want them to jump on the bed because that means I will have to tidy it again. I don't want to give them a snack because that means I have to get up from checking my email to get it for them. I don't want to do that craft right now because there'll be another mess for me to clean up. Hear it? Me, me, me. And now when I know that the days I have with them are few, I find myself saying yes a lot more. Yes, you can have that cookie. Yes, you can jump on the bed. Yes, let's make that craft. I've surprised more than a few people when I have explained that I don't want to build up my kids' self-esteem. Now, this does not mean that I don't give them affirmation or recognize their efforts and successes, but it does mean that I don't want them to find their value in it themselves or anything they do. It is a subtle difference, but it is one I encourage you to listen for, because the focus of life is too often ourselves, when it should be God. And this is the essence of sin. I am already unable to be out of bed for more than a few hours a day. This evening has required a full day in bed, which was disrupted by the fact that I had to go have an MRI, and a lot of drugs to make it possible for me to stand here right now. And that frustrates me. The other day, Kate asked me to pick her up. She's 5, so this doesn't happen very often by the sheer fact that she's just too big. But there she was, standing in front of me with her arms outstretched, asking, "Mommy, will you pick me up, please?" I thought, hoped, rather, that she was asking for something else. Something I could do, because I couldn't pick her up. And I had to tell her so, because if I do, the bones in my back, which are riddled with cancer, are so weak that they will collapse onto my spinal cord. My best friend Shayla saw what was happening and quickly said she could pick her up, and Kate ran to her. But my heart was still broken. It is still broken, but I can't pick up my little girl anymore. And I understandably got frustrated and angry. I rail against the fact that I can't do what I want to do, that I am stuck in bed all day while everyone works and plays around me. The worst moments of each day are the ones right when I wake up, the moments when I'm just coming out of a deep sleep and I'm becoming aware of what time it is, what day it is, and then I remember that I'm dying. My frustration and anger are normal. They are even right, some would say, but at their root, they are unbelief. They are my sinful heart saying, "I don't believe that this is the right thing for me, God. You must not know what you are doing, or if you do, you are not good, or you are not in control, or you are just being unfair, because I don't want this, and you are not giving me what I want." That is what my heart naturally says. And what yours does too, when faced with circumstances we don't like. When someone at work is making things difficult, when someone in our family doesn't do what we would like them to do, when accidents, natural disasters, or disease happen. But God is good. He is in control, and He is fair. And when I try to make Him into a God who serves me, I sin. Our natural bent is to sin, and it is our greatest problem. Know the gospel. The gospel, for those who are unfamiliar with the term, means good news. The good news that, in light of God's perfection and our imperfection, God has made a way for us to know Him, and that way is Jesus. Paul, speaking in his letter to the church in Corinth, says, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that He was buried, that He was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures." When I was a kid, I must have prayed a bunch of times for Jesus to come into my heart. I thought that I had asked Him to come in, but I was afraid He might have left. And then when I got older and was sure that He hadn't left, I didn't really understand the difference that it made for me now. I had my ticket to heaven, so to speak. But what difference did this good news make to me now, today? All the difference in the world. And let me tell you why. What happened on the cross at Calvary was that every sin of every person was placed on Jesus. And God, the Father, poured out His wrath on His Son. And God looked at Jesus, his son, as if he had committed the sins of horrible men and women and was punished for it. Not just the murderers and the child molesters, yes, them too, but my sins and your sins. All the pride, all the selfishness, all the lies, all the unkind thoughts and actions. The second part of Isaiah 53:6 talks to this. The first part we read earlier is about our sin, and then we find out what God has done with it. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his or her own way. And the Lord has laid on him, Jesus, the iniquity of us all. So when you know the gospel, when you know what has been done for you, and you remind yourself of it every day, you don't get offended when someone criticizes you, because you realize that you actually deserve much harsher criticism, but you've avoided it because of Jesus. You forgive your husband or your friend when they slight you or treat you unkindly, because you realize how much you have already been forgiven because of Jesus. You're okay with it when you don't get the credit you deserve, or worse, when somebody else gets it, because you know that you have been given far more than you deserve because of Jesus. You are able to love those who are hard to love, that difficult coworker, that child who is throwing a temper tantrum, the person who abused you. You can love them because of how Jesus loved you when you were unlovable. The gospel is not just a ticket to heaven. It is a whole way of living. I have listed a website at the bottom of the book list that you have in front of you. It's called Two Ways to Live, and explains in a few short pages what the Bible is all about and what Jesus has done for you. For those of you who may be hearing this for the first time, and even for those of you who already know Jesus, I hope you'll take the time to look at it. Some of you who know Jesus still struggle to understand how this applies to your daily life. And even if you do understand, my challenge to you is this. Talk to yourself. Martin Lloyd-Jones says, "Have you realized that most of your unhappiness in life is due to the fact that you are listening to yourself rather than talking to yourself? We do it to ourselves every day. Every morning we wake up and it begins. What day is it? Oh, Wednesday. Oh, great. Another day of laundry and errands. It is never ending. And oh, the car is making that funny noise. You need to get it fixed. And you really should get around to tidying the house. It's a pigsty. You should be ashamed of yourself." And then your feet hit the floor and the talking continues. "Doesn't anyone in this family know how to put away the toothpaste? Do I have to do everything around here?" And on it goes, all day. On a daily basis, we are faced with two simple choices, C.J. Mahaney says in his book, The Cross-Centered Life. We can either listen to ourselves and our constantly changing feelings about our circumstances, or we can talk to ourselves about the unchanging truth of who God is and what he's accomplished on the cross for us in his son, Jesus. I realized that I was spending more time listening to myself rather than talking to myself. But because I knew God, I knew myself, and I knew the gospel, I began to remind myself of these truths daily. I would read books that reminded me of who God is and what Jesus has done for me. You have in front of you my personal book list. I was in a regular Bible study with others who were like-minded in their desire to know Jesus and to seek truth. I made and committed to a plan to regularly read the Bible. I attended a church where Jesus, who he was, and what he accomplished on the cross was regularly taught. I chose friends who would encourage and challenge me in my spiritual walk. All these things I would encourage each of you to do too in your efforts to know Jesus and to talk to yourself. If you haven't already, make and stick to a plan to read the Bible. Join a small group Bible study. Read good books. And I mean books that might even make you uncomfortable. Choose friends who want to know Jesus like you do. I have great friends. Truly, I don't do many things well, but but the one thing I have done well is to pick good friends. And if you are here and you have no idea where to start, talk to the person who brought you if they know Jesus. Choose a good church that talks a lot about Jesus. And if you still don't know what to do, feel free to call or email someone at our church, Westside. Someone would love to help you answer the questions that you have. Because I have done these things, in the midst of conflict, I am able to remind myself of the gospel. In the face of bad news, I remind myself who God is. When I'm standing in front of 500 plus women and worry what they will think about me, I remember that no matter how poorly you think of me, I know that I am worse. I'm not joking. 3 women have been a great encouragement, an example of knowing the gospel to me over the past few years. Each of them is here this evening. They are all relatively new Christians, and each has challenged and inspired me with their desire to know Jesus and live out the gospel each day. Joyce is, in a word, refreshing. She knows herself well and is able to laugh at herself and her foibles like no one else I know. When a difficult issue or question comes up, like biblical submission, Joyce's first reaction is to say, "Okay, I don't get that. I don't like that. I do not understand why God would want it that way." And then she says, "Would someone please explain it to me? I want to know." If she has any biases or prejudices, she is the first one to acknowledge and question them. She is the first one to take responsibility for her own sin. She knows that Jesus has changed her and empowers her to live life well. This is evidence of God's grace in her, and she has taught me much by her humility and willingness to learn. Nadine grew up in a Christian home, but only a few years ago began a personal relationship with Jesus. She has struggled with depression, postpartum depression so severe that it took her to the brink of suicide. Her view of God has changed so that she knows God for who he is, loving and kind, rather than legalistic and punitive. So now, when faced with the challenges of her depression or relational difficulties, she rests in who she knows God is. She wrote to me last week when I asked her permission to speak about her tonight. She said, "My hope is in God, not friends or any other idol. These things will let us down, but God will not. So often I have put my hope in people because it seems to help in the immediate, but it never lasts. They let us down. I let them down. However, God has been my hope and my constant. The peace that I experience is indescribable. How wonderful it is to have a relationship with Jesus." And Patricia. I always feel badly when I say Patricia's name because I know that my pronunciation of it butchers what is no doubt a beautiful Italian name when she says it. Patricia has had many friends and family become ill and die from cancer over the past few years. Too many. In fact, she was one of the first people I thought of when I got the news that my cancer had returned. I thought, oh no, poor Patricia. She does not need one more person she knows to die of cancer. I was worried that her young faith in a good God would be shaken. When I saw her for the first time after we had gotten the news, I told her that she was one of the first people I had thought of and that I felt terribly that I was now a part of all the sickness and death that she has had to endure. And her response was this. "Oh, Rachel," she said, "but God is so good because he has never given them to me all at one time." I should not have worried because Patricia, too, knows Jesus. Each of these women possesses a faith that saves. They know God, they know themselves, and they know the gospel. And the final thing I have learned, know your purpose. The Westminster Catechism, a lot of you haven't probably heard that one before, states, "The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him. This seems, at first blush, a rather odd thing to have as our purpose. It goes against everything our culture tells us that we should want or live for. First of all, to glorify God, what kind of purpose is that? Is God arrogant, selfish, or megalomaniacal? I did it. To want things for his glory? I wish I could answer that for you in depth, but time does not permit. But ask it. Ask it and seek the answer. Don't just dismiss God because you, or assume that you know who he is, because you don't understand him. He is knowable. If you seek the truth, it will stand under the hard questions. As a brief answer, we start where we began. Know God. We know God is perfect, and so his desire for us to glorify him is rooted in this perfection. One author explains this when he says, "When a human glorifies himself, he robs others of joy. Self-aggrandizement and human megalomania cause hurt and harm to others, not blessing and joy. But when God displays and exhibits his glory, he shares joy with his creatures and wholeness with all creation. Put most directly, without the knowledge of God's glory, we would be robbed of true joy." And how do we glorify God? The answer is in the second part of the equation, by enjoying him. By knowing God, by being like Jesus. And what did Jesus do? He served. This isn't on the screen, but Mark 10:45 says, "For even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many." He came to serve us, and he did it joyfully. A few years ago, I was struggling with the daily grind of constantly cleaning and tidying laundry, which I detest, trying to meet project deadlines, cooking meals and washing dishes, replying to work emails, refereeing disagreements with the kids, homeschooling, only to turn around the next day or even the next moment to have to do it all over again. I thought, is this it? Is this all that I'm supposed to be doing? And right about that time, I came across a blog of someone who put it so succinctly, it has stuck with me ever since. They said, "I am here to serve with joy." Up until that point, I had been serving. Leave you me. I was serving and serving and serving. Meals, sippy cups, snacks, housekeeping, diaper changing, toothbrushing, organizing. I was serving, just like Jesus. But I wasn't doing it with joy. Big difference. But through that, I realized that God has given me different roles and put me in specific circumstances for different reasons. But all of them are so I can serve with joy, to glorify and enjoy him. Being here tonight is part of fulfilling my purpose, to serve with joy. Because I know that one of my roles is to encourage and challenge other women in the church. Titus 2 says, "Older women, likewise, are to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be self-controlled, pure, working at home, kind, and submissive to their own husbands, that the word of God may not be reviled." Now, there's a lot in there to talk about. Understatement. But the point is that I am an older woman, despite the efforts of oil of Olay and some serious concealer, and one of my God-given roles is to help other women serve with joy. Another role in which I serve with joy is to share my faith with those who are not Christians. 1 Peter 2:15 says, "Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect." I hope that I have done that tonight for those of you who do not yet know Jesus. And it is for my children. Deuteronomy 6:7 says, "You shall teach them," talking about the things of God, "diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise." I ask that tonight be videoed, so that someday... so that someday Quinn and Kate would be able to watch this and to hear my heart. I have been blessed to be their mother for these years. I have many roles, including others not mentioned here, most notably being a wife, but in all of these I have one purpose, to be like Jesus, to serve with joy. Many have asked why. Why is this happening to you, to Neil, to Quinn and Kate, to your family and friends? I don't ask why, because I know the answer. And here it is. We live in a sinful world. Bad things happen. But it was not supposed to be this way, and it will not always be this way. God has a plan. He has made a way for sinful people, you and me, to be with him in a perfect world. The way is Jesus. Acknowledge that you have sinned and that you have a serious problem before you in light of a God who is perfect and just. Recognize that there is nothing you can do to save yourself, and trust that Jesus, who died to pay the penalty for your sin, has risen from the dead and given you his righteousness. This is the way to know God and someday be free from this world of disease and pain. 1 Peter 3:9 says this: "The Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise, as some count slowness, but is patient towards you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance." So God is being patient. Patient so that everyone has the opportunity to repent and to make things right with him. That is why there is evil and suffering in the world. Because when he does return to bring judgment, there will be no second chances. I am dying, but so are you. Neither of us knows if we will even see tomorrow. And perhaps the reason that I am suffering now, the reason that God is waiting to bring judgment against all the evil in this world, is because he's waiting for you. For you to acknowledge your sin and to turn to him for forgiveness. Maybe you are the one we are waiting for. Jesus suffered. God did not spare him. Why would he spare me if my suffering would result in good for you? If my suffering is the means that God would use to bring even one person to himself, it is an honor for me to suffer. Does that seem strange? I suppose it does. But really, it is the only way that all of this makes any sense at all. A God who sees my suffering, but is unable, or worse, unwilling to spare me? A God who sees my suffering, but allows it with no greater purpose or hope? My God is able to save me, and he will. But save me from what? From a life without him. There is a place where God is not. It is a place where there is nothing good, not even a gentle rain or a child's laugh. It is a place where everything that we despise about this world, the evil, the injustice, is the rule, with no exceptions. Hell is a physical place where God is not. Instead, he will bring me to a perfect world where he is, heaven, where life is full of wonder, adventure, and joy, everything good, for all eternity. My God is able to save me, and he will. This suffering is temporary, and the life I will live in eternity will make all this seem light and momentary. As one speaker explained, God allows in his wisdom that which he could easily prevent by his power. God allows in his wisdom that which he could easily prevent by his power. I chose the title of this talk, Death is Not Dying, A Faith That Saves. The first part came from one of my favorite preachers and authors, Charles Spurgeon, who I realize is not even on the book list in front of you, but you can't go wrong if you find anything by him. And the second came from another of my favorite teachers, our pastor at Westside, Norm Funk, when he recently posed the question from James 2:14, can that faith save? And pointed out that the most important word in that verse is the word that. Can that faith save? We all have faith in something, but not all faiths save. The faith I have saves. So when I say that death is not dying, the part of me that will die is only a shell. The next few weeks or months will not be pretty. Bone cancer is intensely, intensely painful, and I am already bedridden for almost the entire day, taking 3, sometimes 4 different medications to control the pain. Liver cancer causes intense nausea. Last Saturday I woke up and I instantly had to run to the washroom to throw up. I did not stop throwing up all day. And just last week when we learned that the cancer has spread to my skull, it made sense because it has started affecting the nerves in my face. I have not felt hungry in more than 2 months. Any food I do eat is forced down. But it will not always be this way. Soon I will become too weak or in too much pain to get out of bed at all. It will become harder and harder to eat and drink. My body and the cancer will fight over the few calories that I do consume, and eventually the cancer will win, and I will starve to death. That is the most likely scenario. I have lived a seemingly perfect, picture-perfect life from the outside looking in, and in truth, I have been very blessed. But in my life, there have been many difficult things that the Lord has allowed. I have known the shame of being sexually abused. I have made poor decisions in relationships and have hurt others and have been hurt as a result of them. I have known the searing pain of loss with the death of a loved one. I have been diagnosed with cancer 2 now, and this second time, barring a miracle, will end my life before I reach my 38th birthday. In his providence, God has used the tough things in my life to draw me closer to him, to show me his great love, and to teach me many things. I have learned that I am not perfect, and I have the scars to prove it, 13 of them. And they serve as a physical reminder of a spiritual reality that I can never be perfect on my own. I need a Savior. I have learned that the greatest evidence of God's love is seen when I stand at the foot of the cross. He took my shame upon himself and rescued me. I have learned that being a Christian is not just hope for the future, although it is most definitely that, but that it is the joy of knowing and trusting in a God who is loving and faithful no matter what the circumstances. So when I say that death is not dying, death will not kill my soul. It is eternal, just like yours. It is just this physical body that will die, but even it will be raised again, just like Jesus. And it will be better than the one I have now. Like everything, it will be better, because God is going to make everything new. And I know this why? Because I know God, I know myself, I know the gospel, and I know my purpose. I know I have a faith that saves, because my faith is in Jesus alone.